This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
This is the Jesse Kelly Show.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show. Another hour of the Jesse Kelly Show. Of course, we're going to get to Medal of Honor Monday in a minute. Brandon Darby's coming up about a half hour from now. Cartel Chronicles. We will address some of these Trump cabinet picks, some emails, all that and so much more. And again, remember, Ob and the kids, they're out of town for a couple days. That's me right now, only without the torture. I still have all my body parts and stuff, but that's me right now. Braveheart. In fact, we're really similar anyway. But beyond that, let's move on to Medal of Honor Monday. And remember, on top of your Ask Dr. Jesse questions for Wednesday, I need them for Wednesday. You can send in Medal of Honor suggestions or love or hate or death threats, whatever you want. Jesse@jessekellyshow.com. All right. And we got one of these. We have a bunch of them. Chris, make sure that Jarhead reads this, would you? Remember, all your emails go to Jewish producer Chris, and then he prints them off and hands them to me. Please use my grandson's name and mine, Sava, Damien, and Guile. Those are great names. I'm a disabled Coast Guard veteran. We listen every day while I'm driving the turds around to whatever the next sporting event is. And while being the ugliest soccer mom on the planet for my grandsons, oh, you quit that, lady. We'd like to hear about the only Coast Guard stud to receive the Medal of Honor, Douglas Monroe. The more history you do, the more we like it. And without further ado, let's do the Medal of Honor citation, the Medal of Honor celebration of a man who was a lion, Douglas Albert Monroe.
Ready, aim, fire.
Honoring those who went above and beyond, it's Medal of Honor Monday.
For extraordinary heroism and conspicuous gallantry in action above and beyond the call of duty as petty officer in charge of a group of 24 Higgins boats engaged in the evacuation of a battalion of Marines trapped by enemy Japanese forces at Point Cruz, Guadalcanal, on the 27th of September 1942. After making preliminary plans for the evacuation of nearly 500 beleaguered Marines, Monroe, under constant strafing by enemy machine guns on the island and at great risk of his life, daringly led five of his small craft toward the shore. As he closed the beach, he signaled the others to land, and then, in order to draw the enemy's fire and protect the heavily loaded boats, he valiantly placed his craft with its two small guns as a shield between the beachhead and the Japanese. When the perilous task of evacuation was nearly completed, Monroe was instantly killed by enemy fire. He was not, I'll explain in a moment. But his crew, two of whom were wounded, carried on until the last boat loaded and cleared the beach. By his outstanding leadership, expert planning, and dauntless devotion to duty, he and his courageous comrades undoubtedly saved the lives of many who otherwise would have perished. And he gallantly gave his life for this country. And I just want to say a couple things before I play taps for him. That's a very, very short citation, but Monroe is a legend. He's not just a Coast Guard legend. He's a legend, period. He's a Marine Corps legend. When I was in the Marines, we knew about Douglas Monroe. So let me explain why. At Guadalcanal, you remember, as I've tried to kind of lay out for you specifically, when it comes to World War II in the Pacific, and really the greater war, but in the Pacific. Remember, 1942 was a terrible year. That was the beginning of it. We didn't get attacked till December 7th, 1941. Okay, so 1942, that was the year where we had some tough slogs. Some wins, but some tough slogs. We didn't really turn things around till the end of that year, 1943. But in the beginning, we didn't know what we were doing in a lot of different ways. And one of the things we really did not really understand, because it's so difficult and complicated, is amphibious landings. Higgins boats. We were using Higgins boats. That's a boat. All you need to know is that's a boat where if you're a Marine platoon, you get off your big transport ship and you'd step into a Higgins boat, and that's the boat that would drive you to shore. Well, Douglas Monroe, one, had already lived a life of service. He had lived through the Great Depression, but his dad ended up holding his job, and so they considered themselves wealthy. Douglas Monroe used to go to the woods and split firewood to deliver it to people for free so they could have wood and warm their homes in the Great Depression. It just tells you that's the kind of mentality this guy has. He goes down, he signs up for the Coast Guard. Now, move to Guadalcanal. I'm going to have a hard time putting this kind of bravery into words because it's hard to describe. When you are being shot at, if I was to put you, let's say there's a bunch of big boulders, big, huge boulders, the size of a car, and you were standing in and around these big boulders, and I walked 200 yards away from you and started shooting at you, you would still be nervous, wouldn't you? Big boulder or not, ping, bullets bouncing off the ground. You have big boulders in front of you, and still, am I going to catch a ricochet? As the bullets crackling by, you would hear it and you would wince, you would tense up, kind of do that thing. That's with boulders. When you are coming in on the water, there aren't any boulders. There aren't any logs. There aren't any bunkers. There isn't any anything. You are naked as the day you were born. And the Marines were being brutalized on that beachhead. That's why it's so dangerous. You've seen the D-Day stuff. That's why it's so hard to land on a beach and take a beach. There's nothing to hide behind. Everyone's looking down at you. They've prepared their defenses. They know you're coming. Their guns are already sighted in, and they're chopping you up. Chopping you up. And Monroe gets the call on that day to come rescue the Marines because they are being chewed up and spit out. And you need to understand, I've read more World War II in the Pacific books than I can count. You need to understand how many guys who were driving the boats, Higgins boats and otherwise, chickened out. And I wish I didn't even have to put it that way, but I don't have another way. Hey, I'm coming to pick up this group of Marines. Nope, that's too much fire. I'm turning around. I'm leaving. Best of luck. Or I'm coming to drop off this group of Marines or Army guys. There were Army guys there too. Nah, I don't want to get too close. This is too much fire. You guys just get out. And the guys are drowning because he dropped them off too far. It's not as if every one of these guys driving one of these boats was some kind of a lion. It's not how it was. You're vulnerable. You're scared. Most of them signed up to join the friggin' Navy or the Coast Guard. And that's not dogging on the Navy and Coast Guard like I normally would do, but you're not expecting to catch bullets in your face when you do that. And Douglas Monroe, approaching a situation that would have sounded like hell. Can you imagine the screams and the nightmare as you drive up on a boat to a beach where Marines are being slaughtered? What you'd see that day would stay with you in your nightmares for the rest of your life. And as he's driving up, rounds landing all around him. Not only did he not turn around, he chose to put himself in front of machine gun fire on purpose so Marines could get off of that beach and find some safety. And the reason I said that's not true when it says he was killed instantly, oh, he was shot. He was shot in the base of his skull. That's what happens to heroes most of the time. Most of these Medal of Honor citations I read, they're dead. They don't make it through it. He did regain consciousness for a brief second. And you know what Douglas Monroe said? He didn't call for his mommy. He didn't say, tell my wife I love her. Not that there would have been anything wrong with any of those things. You say whatever you want in that moment. His eyes flittered open for the briefest moment before he passed, and he asked, did the Marines make it out? Now, that's awesome.
Thank you.
as I have said many, many times before, I don't know how to raise my sons to be that type of guy, but I want to know. And that's what I want. All right. We're going to get to let's get to this Surgeon General pick. Let's have a frank talk about the cabinet, which I like, I'll tell you, but there are some stinkers in there. Let's talk about that before we get to Brandon Darby. Speaking of saving a life, you don't always have to put yourself in front of a machine gun nest to do that. You can give $28 to preborn. Preborn's out there saving lives, 200 a day. 200 a day. Do the math on what preborn has already done. Saving lives by giving mothers the gift of ultrasound. Young mothers are scared. They're confused. Oftentimes they've been lied to by every influence in their lives, and they think they're just going to pop in the doctor and dump a clump of cells. But when a young mother hears a heartbeat, she chooses life almost every single time for a reason. Because then it's a baby, and that's what you do when you give $28 to preborn. You save a life. Give if you can. Tis the season, right? Preborn.com/Jesse. Sponsored by Preborn. We'll be back.
Jesse Kelly. Back soon.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show on a Monday. Of course, we just had an amazing Medal of Honor Monday. We have Brandon Darby, Cartel Chronicles, coming up 10 minutes from now. I have so many questions for Darby. I might have to keep him on for two segments about Mexico's new president, what we can expect with Mexico and Trump and things like that. But first, I want to do this quick because I don't want to spend a lot of time on it. The cabinet picks. For the most part, I've been very happy with Trump's cabinet picks. They've been very good, for the most part. Hegseth is unbelievable. Home run. Gates would have been really great. Now we have Bondi, who won't be as good. Look, I got this email. Good segment, Marine. Was not impressed by Bondi in Florida. You have it right. I don't think she's going to have the guts to go in and clean house. Listen, maybe she will, maybe she won't. We need people to look internal. But most of these people seem like they want to look internal. Elon, Vivek talk about cutting government. Holman's going to be deporting people. Rubio's, I'm very average on Rubio, but whatever, he's Secretary of State, go hang out with the other losers at the State Department. But there is a stinker in here to a level that I hope the GOP Senate shoots it down. That's how terrible this Dr. Janet or Jeanette, whatever her name is, this Dr. Janet pick is. Trump picked this lady to be Surgeon General. Now, I understand COVID is an obvious blind spot for Trump. It is. Donald Trump was a pretty good president for 3 years and then just lost his mind and crapped all over himself during COVID. Handed the country to Fauci, lockdowns, Operation Warp Speed, everything you could possibly imagine. He was awful. No excuse for it. Again, if this offends you, I don't give a crap. This is not your mommy's show. He was awful. Inexcusably bad. So I guess maybe you can understand maybe you can understand why I'd pick someone like this.
First of all, vaccines save lives. And I am so excited and I thank and I commend Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg for taking action because this affects everyone. This affects our children. It affects adults. I mean, just look at the recent measles outbreak, the biggest outbreak that we've had in decades with measles. And that's no joke.
That's her praising Mark Zuckerberg on Facebook for censoring the truth about COVID. This is going to be our next Surgeon General if she's not stopped. Oh, wait, there's more.
We see more hospitalizations with those under the age of 50 and our children, and we now are running out of ICU beds.
A reminder to you that COVID was never, ever, 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 ever a threat to children at all. The children's numbers are so small, it doesn't even bear talking about. It was never a risk to kids. Your kids' school was shut down for no reason whatsoever. It was all tyrannical and evil.
If you look at Arkansas, Alabama, Louisiana, Tennessee, we are running out of hospital beds. We are running out of ICU beds. The healthcare.
Yeah, we never ran out of hospital beds. Here was her too.
Just if you go outside and there's no one around, then the risk of you picking up the virus is low. But consider this. There could have been someone walking by who coughed and sneezed. And remember, this virus can remain in the air for a few hours. So you are taking that chance of, you know, even though no one's there, was there someone there 2 minutes prior and you could have just walked into...
Yes, the new Surgeon General wanted you to wear a mask outside walking by yourself. I'm not even kidding. She also was very concerned that we weren't going to be able to have enough abortions.
But as a doctor, I'm concerned for safety. I'm concerned, are we going to see an uprise in back alley abortions? Am I going to see young teenagers trying to involuntarily hurt themselves by trying to self-abort their fetuses out of fear and not knowing what to do and not having alternatives?
Okay. I realized she did come out more recently because those are older. And she said she had a change of heart.
We know and we've learned. Lockdowns, the shutdowns, the social distancing, wearing the flimsy surgical or cloth masks, they are not effective. The key here is understanding and knowing your risk and taking the steps to protect yourself. We know what works, we know what doesn't work. Anita, I have taken care of thousands of COVID patients on the front lines these past 3 years of the pandemic, so I can tell you I know firsthand what works. And it's all about focusing on those who are at high risk. Again, you know, when I had patients who were hospitalized or who lost their life from COVID, it wasn't your 19-year-old college student. I had patients that had heart disease, atrial fibrillation, patients who were obese and struggling to breathe.
Okay, all right, let's just get past it and let's just acknowledge what it is. She's not a system challenger. She's a system servant. Probably not a bad person, but a servant of the system. And you know how we talk about the legitimacy you give to these corrupt institutions is the weapon they will use to attack you? She's a human being who gives them all kinds of legitimacy. Well, I mean, Harvard had this to say. And it's really bad. It's a terrible pick. It's a terrible pick. And it's something Trump is still terrible on. He's still out there publicly bragging about Operation Warp Speed, one of the most evil, disastrous pieces of legislation in the history of the United States of America. I'm not going to dwell on it because overall I'm very, very happy with his cabinet, so I'm not going to major on Surgeon General. I am not, but I will tell you, if we get another disease in this country in the next 4 years, you can count me out on listening to either of these two. That's for daggone sure. I'll be banking on myself from now on because these two aren't going to get it done at all. Whatever. Overall, it's a good cabinet. She's a real stinker, and I mean a real stinker, but they both kind of stink on the issue, and we'll move on because I'm not going to get myself upset. I'd rather talk about sweet cartel stuff, and I'd rather talk to you about firefighting equipment. Not only is firefighting equipment really cool and firefighters are cool, but people in Israel need it. Sounds kind of odd, though. Why would they need firefighting equipment? It doesn't make sense. Well, that's because we have an American way of viewing things where we are generally within nice driving distance of somebody who can put out a fire. But there are people all over northern Israel, farmers who have to become firefighters. Because Hezbollah drops these rockets on there and it starts a fire in the friggin' fields. And then there's no one coming to save you. So where does one acquire firefighting equipment? Last time I was in a big box store, I didn't see it. Well, that's where the IFCJ comes in. The IFCJ provides that so people can fight fires and live. These are the things they do because they're on the ground and know about things we don't know about. Help them get some firefighting equipment in these people's hands. 888-488-IFCJ. 888-488-IFCJ. Brandon Darby, next.
The Jesse Kelly Show. On air and online at jessekellyshow.com.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show. And joining me now, my friend, he is the Big Cheese Cartel Chronicles. He knows all about illegal immigration. You need to check out his work at Breitbart, even though his taste in music. Brandon, what was that?
I love Roy Orbison. I will always love Roy Orbison. I think he's wonderful. All the way from that, all the way through the Traveling Wilburys. Love him. Respect him.
Okay, Traveling Wilburys, I do have to give you credit for. End of the Line is one of the more underrated songs out there. I will actually give you that. Okay, anyway, Brandon, first of all, I have a bunch of stuff I want to go over with you. Let's Mexican president, how did Mexico, one, end up with a woman? That is really shocking to me for Latin America. And two, end up with a communist woman as president. What happened?
Well, first off, Mexico is very, very left, right? So... depending on who, well, they've always been very left. I think it has to do, depends who you ask, right? So if you were to ask Steve Bannon, he would probably say that they've experienced abusive forms of capitalism. They've experienced a different form of capitalism than what we've had. And then it's, you know, when you have so few people from a period of time where there was colonialism and there's so few people, there's so little economic freedom, that there's so few people who have all of the wealth, and it's always been that way. And there's so little opportunity because of the lack of economic, you know, of economic freedom that results from corruption, that results from cronyism, that results from, we can go down the line, that people tend to not, you know, people tend to gravitate towards policies, that distribute wealth when there's only 12 people who own everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it kind of stems from there. You know, here, you know, we have a heavy degree of economic freedom, a large degree of economic freedom, but we have that dispersed amongst the many. They do not have that, and they never have. And so people turn towards leftist policies. I don't think it's great. I think that it would be ideal if they had a lot less corruption so their economies could flourish and a lot less cronyism so their economies can flourish. But that's not what they have had. They probably have it more so now than ever, but that's where that stems from.
Okay, so they're generally left anyway. That's how this woman got elected. It's just kind of a left country. I'm just stunned that they would elect a woman, to be honest with you.
Well, here's what happens. So every time there's a new Mexican president, people are fed up with the corruption in Mexico. The new president, insert name, promises to end corruption, promises to do something about violence. So when the current president is trying to appease cartels and there's still violence, then they elect someone who's going to crack down on cartels. When someone cracks down on cartels and there's still violence, then they elect someone who's going to appease cartels, right? This is what happens. It's absurd, but this is what happens. When we talk about Mexico, we've said this on your show many times, Mexico, it's not a failed state. It is considered a fragile state. You have 32 states, well, 31 in the federal district, but say 32 states, and more than half of those territories are under the physical control of paramilitary drug cartels, right? So when the Mexican government wants to go arrest somebody, the feds can't just show up like they do here. They have to send in their Marines. They have to send in their elite military units in force and in mass to go and challenge a cartel who controls territory there. So, and that's most of the spaces along the U.S.-Mexico border as well, by the way. You know, you have to think about that. They live in a very different situation. I think it's a lot of desperation is why people do that.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, actually, I'm sorry we're getting in the weeds, but I find this stuff fascinating. You brought up how they have control. My best friend down here actually is Mexican. His whole family's Mexican. His wife's whole family's Mexicans, and so we're always talking about this stuff. And his family, he wasn't there, but his family, entire extended family, was driving through one of these states to see some relatives that got pulled over by the cartels. And it was a very official thing. Obviously, there was a threat to it, but they said, who are you? Why are you here? They said, this is our name. We're going to see these people. They said, okay, stay right here on the side of the road. As long as you are who you say you are, no problem. They make some phone calls, sit there for an hour. Apparently, they got back the information they wanted. They were given water by the cartels, patted on the back, said, you are free to go and you are safe here. Move on. When you say control, I don't think people understand the level of control these cartels have, that they're paving roads and building schools. They are the government.
They are the de facto government. That's right. In a lot of a number of states in Mexico, you know, people all the time say, "I went to Mexico. It was fine." It's like, where'd you go? You know, you went to Cancun, you went to Acapulco. Where did you go? You know, mm-hmm. because the majority of what Mexicans live under is very, very bad. They can't call 911 like you and I can. And not only can they not call 911, because most of the law enforcement and government apparatus actually are the henchmen for the regional cartel, cool. but they also can't own sufficient firearms to defend themselves. Another leftist, again, we talk about leftism, they hate firearms or they hate guns. So the only people who have them are the government, who works for the cartels oftentimes, and the cartels. And what do you do in a situation like that? Like, what can you possibly do if everyone Nothing. Around you votes to hate and just, you know, hates guns intrinsically? They hate guns as much as we intrinsically, more than we hate communism, because apparently half of our country is okay with it, or almost half of them. but they hate guns like we hate pedophiles, right? Like, they hate guns. It is just ingrained in them. And as a general rule, and it's a, you know, it creates a scenario where people cannot defend themselves and they don't have the freedom to speak out. That's why we do the Cartel Chronicles. Journalists get killed there. It's, you know, every year it's either number one or number two, in the most dangerous places for journalists in the world. People don't realize that journalists get murdered there routinely. When you write about corruption, if, you know, several of, you know, one of our Cartel Chronicle writers who unfortunately passed away in very strange circumstances, he was, you know, living in the U.S. He had gotten citizenship after he fled Mexico because he published the photo of a cartel boss and they were going to kill him. And he ended up, you know, working for us and writing about that. And then after time, he started going back into Mexico and he went to Chiapas and he was writing about corruption in Chiapas, and they're like, "Hey, sorry, the friend you sent here to investigate us, he drowned," you know? And it's like, well, he did drown. I don't know what the circumstances were leading up to that, to that drowning, right? We know that he did drown, and you know, Jerry Arandas, and that was a horrifying situation, but that's what journalists there live under. That's why they write with us, and they write under pseudonyms, so they can publish what they want to publish without, hopefully without getting murdered.
God have mercy. Kind of brings it home every time you see an American millionaire on television talking about how brave they are for speaking out against Donald Trump. Anyway, Brandon.
Yeah, it never ceases to amaze me when I hear people say that. They're like, "You have so much courage getting on the stage at the Grammys and saying something about Trump." But you have got to be kidding me. That you call that courage. You know, who has courage are the journalists in Mexico who are writing about this stuff under pseudonyms, hoping that, you know, like, it's one thing for me to write about cartels. I live here. I have more firearms than I have toes and fingers and other extremities, right? If you added all my extremities together, I have more firearms than that. They do not. Like, it doesn't take much courage for me to write about them because I can defend myself. I can call 911. But it takes a lot of courage for them to live in that and just hope that I don't accidentally reveal their name, or, you know, that someone doesn't figure out it was them who sent me a report or sent me a photo of something. It takes a lot of courage. So when people in the U.S. talk about that, it blows my mind, to say the least.
Yeah, no doubt about it. All right. Brandon, You have one more in you, or one more segment in you, real quick?
Absolutely, I have as many segments good. As you want.
I want to talk about
for another hour.
Good. I want to talk about Trump and these plans and the military and things like that. Before we get to that, we will be back with Brandon Darby, Cartel Chronicles. I told you need to go nerd out on the Cartel Chronicles. I do it just because I'm a dude and it makes me feel like I'm involved in Sicario or whatever. First, you need to get your T levels up if you're going to read Cartel Chronicles, though, because your T levels are probably too low for that much manliness and violence and stuff. Now, I don't think you actually need T levels for that, but still, you do need to get some chalk in your body. Natural herbal supplements from Chalk. C-H-O-Q. The anti-communists at Chalk, they're on a mission to revitalize this country. We have lost half of our testosterone in 50 years. If you're a dude and you're listening to this, your T levels are probably too low. "Oh, but I'm only 20. Get them checked, brother. You too. That's what estrogen does to you. We drink it. It's in the water. Go get a Chalk subscription. CHOQ.com. Male Vitality Stack. Black Friday specials. Use the code Jesse. We'll be back. It is the Jesse Kelly Show on a Monday. It's been an amazing Monday. Remember, if you miss any part of the show, download the whole thing. iHeart, Spotify, iTunes. Back with Brandon Darby, Big Cheese at the Cartel Chronicles, Breitbart. You got to go read all of his stuff that they do. Okay, Brandon, Donald Trump is obviously coming into office. There's a lot of talk about mass deportation, and there's already a lot of talk about his relationship with Mexico's president. What can and can't we expect from Mexico's president? Because clearly she's not going to want to crack down quite as much as Trump is going to want to crack down.
Correct. So what we can expect is we can expect two things. We can expect Mexico to use mass migration at our southern border as a bargaining chip with the U.S. government, as they always do. We can also expect Mexico to play the United States against China and China against the United States, because that's what they do. When Mexico needed communications infrastructure, it wasn't the United States who got that contract. It was Huawei, right? So a lot of Mexico's infrastructure, they're starting to turn toward China, which then makes the U.S. go, no, okay, we'll give you money at a much more favorable rate. Yeah, we'll do it because we don't want them to become a satellite of China, right, on our border. So that's what we can expect from them. We can expect that when the U.S. is doing what they want, Mexico will crack down on migrants. And when the U.S. is not doing what they want, Mexico will allow them to flood our southern border. That's what they'll do. So the change here is that Trump will, generally speaking, I think Homan for sure, will make sure that people coming to the border know that they will not be allowed in. So we're going to either see one, then build up at the southern border ahead of the next election like they did last time, or two, they're just not going to come anymore in large numbers. And so it's a little bit complicated, but Mexico is absolutely going to use that bargaining chip because that's what they always do.
Brandon, what do you think of Tom Holman, Kristi Noem, head of DHS? What are your impressions with this crew coming in? Are you impressed, hesitant? Where are you at with them?
With the border stuff, Holman, absolutely impressed. Absolutely. You know, when I have an interesting history with that person, when he was going to get nominated by Trump previously, all we had and knew about him was what he had said and what he was on video saying under the Obama administration, where he was also an official, lower level official. And I was not happy with it. And I wrote about it and I used his own words and things that he said and what his agenda was. But then once he was in a seat, a position to do something, and he was allowed to speak freely, he did. And he said, look, I talked to him, I did an interview with him on air, and I said, I'm having a hard time reconciling what you've said years ago on camera and what you're saying now. And he said, well, my job was in that position was to serve under this president and to implement the will of that. This president had asked me what I want to see and what I think needs to be done, and here's what I want, and here's what I think needs to be done. It's just that, you know, I was a good soldier. And it's like, okay, I accept that. And it turns out he was. And so I think that he will absolutely crack the heads of transnational criminal organizations. I think he will make sure that as few pull factors exist for people to come here illegally. I think he will absolutely do exactly what he's saying he's going to do. I think he will. And so that pick is probably my favorite pick that Trump has done. I'm also very happy about Sebastian Gorka. I know him. He is a good man. I know people, you know, attack him all the time and what have you, but it's not popular to like Seb, but he is a good man and he will do a good job. So yeah, I'm pretty happy with most of the picks. The Matt Gaetz thing, I wasn't bothered enough to say anything, but I had some concerns about that, but not enough that I was going to publicly, you know, call it out.
Brandon, why don't cartels hurt journalists here? Why don't they come over here and hurt journalists. And as much as I hate journalists, I'm not actually cheering for something like that. I don't want anybody to be hurt. But why is that not something that happens here? I mean, we can say, well, America would step in. Yeah, if Rachel Maddow gets killed by Sinaloa, we're going to step in. But if they took out some local newspaper man in McAllen, Texas, the federal government would not step in, right?
Well, first off, okay. So one of the arguments against Breitbart and against, you know, what we do in Mexico is that we are reinforcing a white nationalist agenda because we are making Mexico look scary. And so what you have is a lot of U.S. journalists, the majority of U.S. journalists, the reason they don't write about it is they're afraid it's going to reinforce a right of center political narrative, or they're afraid that it's going to make that they're somehow being racist by pointing out that there's so much violence in these communities south of our border. Right. So they don't write about it. So now the consequence of that is that they're participating in silencing these communities. And making sure they don't have a voice, right? There's communities of color who don't have a voice, and they're not bringing them a voice because they're afraid of looking racist. So why don't cartels do something to U.S. journalists? Well, what U.S. journalists are doing anything to challenge the cartels? There's none except for us. I mean, there's none except for us. And, you know, Fox has a good guy, Bill, and there's a few guys who are really calling out what's happening on the border, but who else is really challenging the cartels? What other U.S. outlet, I'm being serious, other than myself, Ildefonso Ortiz, what other U.S. outlet is like actually challenging them, exposing their money, where they hide their money, what they look like, what their real names are, who their lieutenants are, what their phone numbers are, who's really exposing them besides us? I mean, really, who's doing it? No one. And they probably don't kill me, because if you Google me, my history with the FBI, my connections to the White House and to Bannon, it looks like to them, it looks like I'm some highly connected, FBI White House connected. To them, it probably looks pretty scary, and they probably don't want to mess with that. Is what I assume. They probably also know that if they showed up there, there's lead going back at them. They're not accustomed to that, right? They're generally accustomed to just dominating and being bullies. And so historically, when they have come after us and they have done things to us, we've made such a big stink about it that both the U.S. government and Mexico ramped it up against the individuals who came after us. When one of them in Michoacan put a $100,000 hit on one of my writers, was within 48 hours, he had his door kicked in and was incarcerated and stirred up so much trouble for them that they just leave us alone. Do I think that other U.S. journalists would get the same treatment that we get? Probably not, unless they were as aggressive as we are, right? But historically, when they come after us, we go after them. We write about them so much. We put resources into it. Then the U.S. government gets involved and the Mexican government gets embarrassed, so they go after those guys. And these people know that if they come after us, that's we're going to double down, and it's ultimately, just like with Comandante Toro, going to result in their incarceration or their death.
You keep after them, my friend. Brandon Darby, everybody, thank you, my brother. I love Pure Talk. I love Pure Talk because of what I used to do. And here's what I used to do. I used to support every evil company out there that hated my values. Even once I found out they hated my values, I had that lame mentality of, well, I mean, we don't really boycott. That's not, no. You put your money where your morals are. Support people who share your values and stop supporting people who hate your values. Verizon, AT&T, and T-Mobile hate you. Pure Talk is the most pro-America company I think I've ever talked about in my life. They only hire Americans. Nobody else does that. Who does that? Pure Talk does that. Pure Talk, when you get a hold of somebody in customer service, it's an American who speaks English. Their CEO fought for this country in Vietnam. That's how incredible Pure Talk is. Switch your cell phone service and you'll save money. If for no other reason, do that. Dial #250 and say Jesse Kelly. #250, say Jesse Kelly. We still have another hour. Hang on.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.